I know that you were scheduled to be here later on, but you were able to come earlier, and that sort of service a rescue for us. Thank you very much for availing yourselves, Mr. Ramboros and your team. Let's welcome you and say that we're looking forward to our interaction with you with your annual on your annual report. Without a waste of time, let me indicate on the side of the members that we normally on Fridays have a challenge. We had members during the course of the week. We had quite a hectic week. But due to, especially on the opposition side, party political engagements are normally on Fridays. And others had to leave because, you know, we most of us live in the rural areas where connecting flights are a very problematic issue. I also don't know how I'm going to connect. Other members still have to leave early because their last flights, they have last flights here, which run between 4 and 5. So it's unfortunate that we had to see you this time, but it's important that we interact with you before we conclude our report to the Parliament. So otherwise, we are happy to have you today here, and as few as we are, we'll be able to interact sufficiently with you. May I, without any waste of time, hand over to yourself for the presentation.
Thank you very much. We'll follow then from the slides, and you know, my first slide that's titled The Work of the Commission is just a reminder to everybody about the organizational functions that's the subject of our annual report. This, you know, the Commission has a mandate to fulfill in terms of the Act, and we identify and prosecute anti-competitive behavior, we prevent further concentration in markets through merger control, and we do advocacy work to persuade different stakeholders to adopt pro-competitive policies and conduct. And we've achieved this, as we've reported previously, through prioritizing our work very carefully, and you will see that a lot of the issues that we've reported on previously as issues we had, where we had, you know, in markets and sectors where we'd initiated investigations are now coming to fruition. I pointed out before that prioritization is not something we do every year because it takes a good, you know, it's a multi-year process to conclude some of these projects that we've begun, and a number of them are coming to conclusion. Of course, we'll talk a little bit about the operational support we need as an organization and how the governance in the organization works. The third slide, entitled Investigations, shows us, this is the core of our work, essentially, the investigations we do into anti-competitive behavior. And what's clear here is that over the past few years, there's been a steady increase in the number, in the total number of cases that we are looking at. In terms of our priority sectors, I will speak here to the four major priority sectors are food and agro-processing, infrastructure and construction, intermediate industrial products, and financial services. And I will just pick out some of the more interesting and more meaningful and big issues that we've dealt with in each of these sectors, our major achievements, in other words. Our annual report covers all of them and lists at least all the issues that we're dealing with, and more detail can be found there. You'll find that if you look at the cases that we've initiated in the financial year under question, most of them do indeed fall within the priority sectors, although they, we don't reject good cases that fall outside of these sectors, but so naturally most of our prosecutions fall within the priority sectors. I think one of the most interesting things that happened, I'm now on a slide that says pioneer food settlements. I think one of the more interesting things that has happened in this financial year under question in the food and agro-processing sector is a settlement that we reached with Pioneer Foods. Now, this settlement closes, in fact, our case on the bread cartel. You all recall that in the bread cartel, which was exposed 3-4 years ago, one of the parties was a corporate leniency applicant, so that party wasn't prosecuted. Two of the parties opted to pay fines, and they paid those fines to the bread cartel, but the fourth party, namely Pioneer Foods, contested our case within the tribunal, and in other words, they challenged us and argued that we didn't have indeed a case against them. We fought that case in the tribunal, and we won that case on the bread cartel. And subsequent to having won that case, where the tribunal in fact imposed the highest penalty on them, the parties came to us and sought to settle all the remaining cases they had with us, which had to do with mostly the milling industry and some other related food industries like poultry. And in the settlement, this slide depicts what happened in that settlement. And essentially, the settlement had three components to it. Firstly, there was a R500 million penalty, a fine imposed on this firm for R500 million. But the interesting thing about that R500 million is 180 million of that was set aside to specifically set up an agro-processing competitiveness fund to be administered by the IDC. Page, I don't know what the page number is, but the slide reads Pioneer Food Settlement.
Page 3.
Okay, so we're talking about the Pioneer Food Settlement, page 3. And here I said there's three components. One was a 500 million rand penalty, of which 180 million rand was used to set up the fund. The purpose of that fund was to fund new entrants into the bread and the bread market. Of course, the fund is more broader than bread; it's agro processing. But we had identified.
Wow.
that we'd identified in our analysis of this market that one of the problems was that there were just, you know, a few players, and the big structural issue that needed to be addressed in this market in order for there to be more competition was if new players could enter this market and provide competition to the existing players. And, you know, in a market like bread, you don't have to be a kind of national kind of bread distributor. We had, I think, the Agro-Processing Competitiveness Fund has in mind also opening up small bakeries, which are small and medium enterprises. So it's not necessarily setting up other big industrial concerns like the existing ones. And so it was agreed through quite a controversial process, in fact, that 180 million rand off the 500 million rand penalty would be given to the IDC to set up this fund. I should comment a little bit on the controversy around this. Is, you know, as I said, we kind of worked out, okay, two steps back, is that one of the criticisms that the competition authorities have been receiving from a wide range of different stakeholders is that while it's great that we're fining these fund companies, everybody wants to know, well, where does the money go to? And the criticism is that this money is going into the fiscus and is getting lost amongst all the other issues and priorities that the fiscus has to deal with when it allocates money to different sectors and needs, and a suggestion that we shouldn't allow this because these penalties are levied over specific types of behaviors in specific markets. It's unfair to kind of just throw it into the pot and it gets swallowed up. We should try to use some of this money specifically to address the problems that were the subject matter of the case. And it was through that thinking that we said, well, you know, what do we need to kind of address the problems here beyond just the fine? Well, let's get in new players, more competition. And we kind of imposed this on the parties, but National Treasury, and looking back quite correctly, pointed out to us that it was not our job as the Competition Commission to decide how money in the fiscus gets spent. That's the job of Parliament, only they can do it, and we have no business to set up these funds independently of a decision from Parliament. We must, all 500 million rand must go to the fiscus, and the Minister of Finance agreed that when he, in his budget speech, he will take the, you know, he will announce the 180 million rand that went to the Agro-Processing Competitiveness Fund, and that indeed did happen. So, you know, it seems like an agency like us cannot kind of use this money to do this kind of thing. Eventually, this has to be the appropriation bill. It has to work according to the appropriation principles and the Appropriation Act around how money that comes into the fiscus gets spread out. You know, we were told, look, you know, in Parliament's wisdom, they might decide that this money is better used for primary school education, and it's Parliament's prerogative to decide that. We couldn't decide that, and we need to work with the system if we want to set up these kinds of funds. So Treasury wasn't opposed in principle with what we were doing and the logic behind setting up such a fund. They just wanted proper procedure to be followed. The other very interesting thing about the settlement is that the companies agreed in settling with us that they would reduce the price of bread to the tune of 160 million rand. In other words, they'll forego profits of 160 million rand, and that amount of money will be put back into the consumers' pockets by decreasing the price of bread. This now indeed did happen in December and January, December 2010 and January 2011, where at least in our monitoring we found that the price of the Sasco brand, which is Pioneer's brand, did fall. In fact, not only companies, other bread companies, in order to maintain their market share, also dropped some of their prices. So in December and January this year, consumers did benefit from a lower bread price than would otherwise have been the case. We at the Commission are evaluating this and looking at, you know, facts and figures on precisely to what extent it has happened, but that was also now a very innovative new kind of remedy that the Competition Commission is beginning to put into place. All of this in response, I think, to a very kind of rich and useful and deep public debate around our work, and we've kind of listened and incorporated some of those principles into what we're doing. The third part of this very innovative settlement is that Pioneer Foods agreed to increase its capital expenditure by an additional 150 million rand over and above their planned capital expenditure, and that was something that would kind of would increase capacity in this market and the ability of this country to produce these products, which is bread in this case. So that's about the Pioneer Food settlement. In terms of generally speaking, in terms of our work, our corporate leniency applications have been steadily increasing. In the period under review, it was down from the previous year, but it's still a substantial number of corporate leniency applications we were getting. One of the things with respect to the corporate leniency that occurred in the year under review was that our powers, the Competition Commission's powers to implement a leniency program, was challenged in the high courts by companies that we were prosecuting in the wire sector, the steel stroke wire sector. And in that instance, one of those companies in the wire cartel had applied for corporate leniency and provided us with information, and the other members of the cartel challenged the very existence of our corporate leniency. They said that we didn't have the legal powers or the legal mandate to put together such kind of mechanism. So it went to the High Court, and the decision came out after this year, in the current financial year, and the High Court confirmed our powers to embark on such a program. It said we did have the prosecutorial discretion to put into place such a program, but it kind of justified that in terms of the law, and it said in any event, you know, if there was any problem with it, the fact that the Competition Tribunal has oversight over this is a check and balance in the system to ensure that the system works, you know, in accordance with good legal principles. A very interesting thing that we put into place, we conceptualized and put into place in the previous financial year, is in the current year being implemented, is our construction fast track project. Here, this project came into being when we began to realize the extent to which bid rigging or collusive tendering is occurring in these markets, in the construction markets. So these are all the markets that build roads and build airports and stadiums in that period. And we, as you know, prioritize infrastructure and construction as one of our priority areas, because government was spending an enormous amount of money in this sector, and collusive practices would have raised the costs to government, and preventing it from happening means that there'll be more money left in the fiscus to do other things with. And so we put together this this project where essentially we wanted to incentivize all the firms that were involved in bid rigging to come clean with us, you know, kind of tell us exactly what, give us truthful and comprehensive disclosure of their involvement in these bid rigging cartels, in do, doing so, that would strengthen the evidence we have against those parties that don't cooperate with us in this mechanism, and it would minimize a lot of our legal costs, because it's very, very expensive to be prosecuting these cases. And this was an opportunity for this entire sector to come clean and put behind them this kind of disgraceful conduct and start off on a brand new slate, as it were, because clearly in the foreseeable future, our government, and indeed governments elsewhere in Africa, are going to be spending an enormous amount of money on infrastructure development. So having kind of bust the cartel, as it were, means that governments will be getting a better value for money for the projects they're undertaking. And essentially, the way we've done this is all of the companies must kind of give in an application. They must tell us all the projects that they were involved in where there was bid rigging. They must tell us who the other companies were in each of those projects that were involved in bid rigging. And we'll evaluate all of these applications. We'll either accept or reject them based on certain criteria we set out, and the successful applications we'll settle with parties, and we'll settle at far lower rate than we would have had we prosecuted them. So that's their incentive to be involved. You know, they can tell us all the projects and put it behind them, and they'll pay a much lower fine than if we remember, for each of these projects we could fine them for up to 10%. So there's 10 projects, that's 100% of their turnover, and we made it very attractive by saying, well, you know, by categorizing the number of projects, attaching a percentage fine for different categories of the number of projects. And so the penalty gets calculated on the basis of how many projects they've colluded over, and we will take these settlements to the tribunal for ratification. We expect that this project is something that will come to an end early next year, in the first quarter of next year, which is the current financial year. And we have also made it very clear to parties that should they not cooperate with us, we will pursue prosecutions against them. And over and above that, we have said to parties that should they not cooperate with us and they're found to be guilty in the end, we will recommend to government that they be excluded from all further tenders for government projects. So that's on the construction sector. In the intermediate industrial product sector, we've had a number of very significant settlements. In the fertilizer market, I'm now on a slide that says settlements in intermediate industrial products. In the fertilizer market, we reached an agreement with Sasol Chemical Industries on a case in the fertilizer market where they were abusing their dominance. This company, Sasol, there were two problems in the fertilizer market. There was where Sasol was supplying ammonia, which is one of the products that makes up fertilizer. It was a dominant player. But Sasol also operates in the market that makes and sells the fertilizer itself. And in the lower, in where it makes and sells the fertilizer, we found it was colluding with other firms at that level of the market, the other firms that were making and selling fertilizer. They settled that case with us in the previous year and paid a 250 million rand fine for the collusion case. Now for the abuse of dominance case, where they are the main supplier of an important constituent of fertilizer, they settled that case with us by agreeing to divest five of their plants. So the plants that produced this product, they agreed that they would sell it to other independent players and no longer own it. You know, and once that happens, of course, they're no longer the dominant player in that market, because there's other players that are also making that same product. So divestiture is quite a serious remedy. It's not used very often because you're essentially asking a firm to sell, to break up and sell parts of it, part of what it owns to other players. And this we did in a settlement process. In other words, it didn't go to an adversarial process in court. They agreed, they saw the sense of it. And in addition to that divestiture, they've also agreed that their pricing going forward won't discriminate between different players, between different customers. The second settlement is in polymers and plastics, polymer products which are used to make all kinds of plastics. It's a very big market in packaging in particular, but also has industrial applications. And here this was a collusion case also involving Sasol. And two of the companies there, Sasol and Safripol, agreed to pay penalties of, in the case of Sasol, 111 million rand, and in the case of Safripol, 16.5 million rand. And then the third major significant settlement in this sector of intermediate industrial products was in the reinforcing steel and wire mesh markets. This was a collusion case, and the biggest company there, Aveng, agreed in a settlement to a penalty of 129 million. The other very significant thing, I'm now on a slide that says banking inquiry. You will all recall that three, four years ago, the Commission conducted a banking inquiry, and essentially that banking inquiry, you know, it came into being because of a lot of public concern around high bank charges, and we kind of responded to this issue that was out in the public domain. But what the inquiry found at the end, if you recall, was while they identified all of the competition issues, all the problems in this market relating to competition, they concluded that the regulatory regime, in other words, the manner in which the financial sector more broadly, but specifically the banks, were regulated, was key to the problem. In other words, what needed to change here was not was not something that we could achieve through prosecuting these banks through the competition law. What really needed to change was the manner in which the banks were regulated. Now, this has a very kind of unique history, this, because our inquiry was being done right slap bang in the middle of a major financial crisis in 2008. And so there were lots of sensitivities around how we articulated these views, because nobody wanted us to send out signals that our banking system was problematic in any way. But we had very frank and honest discussions with National Treasury around why this was important, notwithstanding their own kind of custodianship of the financial system and wanting to kind of project our system as being one that has integrity. And they and we worked for over a year in kind of a series of monthly meetings of exchanging policy ideas with them. And in the financial year under review that I'm reporting on, the very significant thing that happened was that National Treasury put out a new policy paper around how to deal with all of the issues in the financial sector. In truth, some of that came from a rethink around banking policy and financial sector policy that occurred post the crisis. So lots of countries were doing this post the financial crisis, looking at what were the problems around regulation. But interestingly and importantly, all of our ideas that came out of the banking inquiry has been incorporated in National Treasury's policy stance on this. This is still, I think, I'm not sure where we're at on that process now, but certainly it's kind of the subject of discussion now. They're not finalized, but one of the important recommendations in the policies is for a new regulator to be set up to look at the market conduct of banks. And that was something we pushed for in our market inquiry. That, in other words, that in regulating the banks, you don't only look at systemic risk issues, which Treasury is usually very firm on protecting, that the market conduct regulator would look at how banks behave in the competitive environment, and whether that is that disadvantages consumers in any way. A lot of the consumer issues that came up in our banking inquiry has also been taken up by the Banking Association of South Africa, who are reviewing their code of conduct and incorporating a lot of the ideas that were generated through our inquiry. And the consumer, the newly formed Consumer Commission, is also, we've worked with them and they're keen to pick up on some of the consumer-related issues that their law is better able to address than competition law. And in terms of access to the national payment system and fees charged by banks, the South African Reserve Bank is also looking, I think they've got a white paper, a green paper, some policy document, rethinking how that works. So in total, this inquiry has enabled policymakers dedicated to banking policy to understand more clearly what the competition issues are, and they've picked up in a lot of them in reviewing the policies that they work off. Okay, this is a bit of a complicated slide that looks at what I'm on a slide that says contraventions prosecuted. And essentially, this slide is just saying, look, these are, if you look at the different sections of the Act and what the Competition Act prohibits, what kinds of behaviors, this slide is just a picture, of respectively, which are the kinds of issues we're picking up. And clearly, the one color has the biggest space in these bar charts is section 41B, which are cases of collusion. So in the majority of cases, the slide tells us that we are prosecuting it, has to do with collusive behavior. Now, as time went on, in an earlier period, a lot of the work of the commission was being done in the mergers division and by the division that does the investigations. But what happened in the last 2 or 3 years is that a lot of, as our investigative ability improved, more cases went into litigation. So if you look at the kind of the chain, the work flow of the organization, we now have increasingly more cases that are before the courts and being litigated. And so our legal services division has become one of the more important divisions, generating most of our work in the recent past. And the slide that says legal services tells you the kinds of cases we're talking about, the number of contested mergers cases, number of cases complained to the tribunal. But interestingly, there are a significant higher number of cases before the higher courts, in other words, the Competition Appeal Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal, and also the High Court, and that was the case I mentioned earlier around the corporate leniency policy. And what's also happening is, while there's also more cases before the courts, there's a drastic increase in the number of settlements we're reaching as well. So a lot of parties are happy to settle with us rather than have a kind of protracted adversarial process. The sum total of all of this is, in the financial year under review, we have levied penalties of about 800 million rand. Okay? This is without, I think it's needless to say, this is a good few multiple times more than our entire budget. So, to put it crudely, we're putting more money into the fiscus than we're taking out of it as an institution. But a very important and significant thing has happened in this area, and that is, in this recent past and in the period, a number of parties have begun challenging the Commission's cases before the courts on procedural grounds, and have won a number of these cases.
So they challenge us on procedural, not on the merits of the case. So we know, everybody knows there's a milk cartel. And they say, okay, well, you know, some of the parties admitted to be involved in the milk cartel. But they go to court and they challenge us on procedural grounds. They win the case on procedural grounds. And the case then falls away. We don't get to the merits of the case. A lot of these cases come from, a lot of the cases that are like this all derive their power or their from one decision that was taken in the Supreme Court of Appeal on the milk cartel, kind of popularly referred to as the Woodlands case. And what happened there is that the judge decided that so just to take one step back, the process in the competition authorities is you get a complainant making a complaint, then the commission investigates that complaint, and after investigation it refers it to the tribunal for prosecution, and the tribunal then takes a decision. So there's a complainant, investigation, referral, and then a hearing and a decision. So that's the kind of process. And what the Supreme Court of Appeal decided in that first case was that whatever it is that a complainant complained of, if a complainant complained of something, whatever it is, the commission could only investigate what was complained of and not investigate anything else beyond what was complained of. So if in the course of our investigation we found additional practices or additional anti-competitive behaviors or other things that broke the competition law, the court says that we are not allowed to refer any of those matters, the additional matters, to what was complained of for prosecution to the tribunal. They said we could come back and start a new investigation or amend the existing investigation, but we couldn't on the basis of that, and because we hadn't come back and started afresh or amended the initiating one, whatever went to the tribunal therefore falls away because we were referring matters to the tribunal that was not complained of. Okay? So that's conceptually the one case, and a lot of the other cases has to do with similar things at every step of the way. So another case says, well, whatever was complained of, that's the only thing the tribunal can take a decision on. And then they get into very very complicated discussion on, well, if somebody complained of a concerted practice, complained of collusion, we can't find that there was a concerted practice. Well, that's a very technical point, because even in language they mean similar things. So we've had, the bottom line here is a lot of decisions against us on very important cases. We've put a lot of energy into investigating these cases. We've got kind of proof that we think is beyond question. But people are not addressing the case, the merits of the case. They're trying to catch us out on certain finicky procedural things that we may or may not have done. And key to all of this is, in our view, that the courts have confused a criminal standard with a civil standard. So they want us as an authority to apply criminal standards in our procedures, but we don't criminalize people in the end. Our fines are administrative penalties and civil law essentially, and that's the one confusion. But the court is arguing that, look, these fines are so high, they're akin to, that's the word, exact words used by, they're akin to criminal fines. Therefore, because they're akin to criminal fines, the standard must be of a criminal nature. And it makes sense, I suppose, if you are in a criminal situation, if you're being investigated or accused of something, there must be some level of precision around that, because everybody has a right in a criminal case to defend themselves, and if you don't know precisely what you're defending yourself against, then there's an unfairness in terms of criminal law around that. But these are not criminal cases in our instance. So this is a very big legal issue for us. Now, what we've done with these cases is we have, and this has been reported, this is outside of the period now, a lot of this happened in this period, but subsequently what we've done, and this is reported recently in the newspapers, is we are taking all of these cases, or as many as we competently can, to the Constitutional Court. We want clarity from the, we think there's an unfairness in these decisions, that there's an unfairness to the complainant in this decision. In other words, these decisions require people who come and complain to us, ordinary people off the street who are, you know, who are not economists or lawyers, but they require a level of sophistication from the complainant that is completely unreasonable. Complainants must come and tell you exactly what's going on, what section of the act it falls under, and, you know, that's an access to justice point, because if we require ordinary citizens to have that level of sophistication, nobody's going to get justice through this law. So that's our main point, that this undermines the rights of complainants to complain to us. And we're also pointing out to the courts that the nature of anti-competitive behavior is such that you can't always, and this is what the tribunal has said, South African Breweries, for example, is one of the companies that have used this point to get out of a case. And in that matter, you know, the point was made that, you know, these anti-competitive behaviors are sophisticated, they evolve all the time, they change, you can't pigeonhole them, and you can't just confine it to one thing, because a whole bunch of different things might be happening. And in any event, you know, somebody who is complaining will not know what exactly the mechanism was through which people colluded. All they will know is the consequences of that collusion. So they'll know, look, you know, the prices are high, or they discriminate. That's the consequences. They'll experience the consequences. But it's just unreasonable to expect a complainant to, you know, therefore know exactly in some greater level of detail or sophistication what those behaviors were, for us to write them clearly up front. And the final point is that, you know, what all of these decisions are doing is they mistaking a complaint for a referral. When you refer a case against somebody, fair enough, at that point you need to be clear on what you're accusing them of. But when somebody complains, you know, that's just a complaint. People are not defending themselves against the complaint. They'll defend themselves against whatever the case made against them was after the investigation. So we are taking all of these cases to the Constitutional Court because it's important for us to win this point in principle. I'm fairly confident about our arguments here, but this is law, and lawyers are very clever, so we'll see how the kind of case gets played out, but it's something to watch. What we've done so far is a number of these cases, we're going to bypass the lower courts and take it directly to the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court is very reluctant to receive cases that don't come properly through the system, but we're making an argument that this has resulted in a crisis for us. If we don't unblock this, we're going to have to abandon a lot of very important cases, and that's a problem. So we want clarity, and that's part of the argument. So we've approached, where we're at right now, is we've approached the Constitutional Court to make that, to get direct representation, and we will hear from them as to whether they allow that or not. Okay, I make a big story of this because it's very current and it's kind of happening, and something that we'll pick up on as it goes forward. And so I want to move on now to our mergers division. Our mergers, you'll see that over time, our mergers have kind of steadily increased and there's a sudden decrease, and there's two reasons for the sudden decrease. One, you'll recall, is we raised the merger thresholds, which means that, you know, for compulsory notification of mergers, there's a threshold beyond which only you refer, so below that you don't. And when we raised it, we're going to get fewer cases notified. But also, in the past 2 years, you'll see the drop has been more dramatic in 2009, 10, and then only slightly picking up again. And that has to do, quite frankly, with a decrease in merger activities worldwide post in this period of financial turmoil that we're experiencing. That's been the general trend, the downturn in merger activity. One of the things we have done with respect to mergers is that we do monitor the small mergers that are non-notifiable more carefully and ask for them to be more notified, even though there is compulsory notification of them. So you see that that happening. There's more of the smaller mergers that are being notified. So in this period under review, we approved 200 mergers without conditions. 65 of these were large and 135 intermediate. 14 mergers were approved with conditions, and these conditions related to divestiture, where four instances where, as condition to the merger, the merging parties had to sell off part of their businesses. In four of the cases, we put restrictions on the number of jobs that could be lost. In two cases, we made it obligatory for the merging parties to supply certain customers that they might have not wanted to supply previously. And in four of the cases, it was around access to an infrastructure that they allowed competitors access to that they might have not done so had we not made these conditions. Two intermediate mergers were prohibited in this period, one of which I'll speak about just now. And we found that in 12 transactions where there were kind of there were negative impacts on employment, we considered them, and that's where some of the restrictions on job losses come in. Four of them, we placed restrictions. In truth, most of these had to do with two cases. The Metropolitan and Momentum merger, where the tribunal imposed on these parties a moratorium on retrenchments, and they wanted to retrench 1,500 workers. And in the case of Rhodes and De Monte, which is a merger of the food market, there were 1,037 employees affected there. Now, perhaps the most dramatic thing that happened in the period under review was the acquisition of Massmart by Walmart. Now, this committee had public hearings on this matter and are quite familiar with the issues here. But I should say that from the competition authorities' evaluation of this merger, we found that it did not increase concentration in the markets. It didn't kind of increase the concentration. There were the same number of players before and after the merger, pre and post merger. It's just that one of them had a different owner post merger. And we, on competition grounds, approved the merger or recommended approval of the merger. Of course, many other parties were very concerned about the impact this merger would have on employment and the effect that Walmart's procurement strategy would have on local manufacturing, where it was argued that because they have this sophisticated logistical system to get, you know, goods from everywhere else in the world, our local manufacturers would be undermined in some way, and that would result in closing down our own manufacturing capacity and jobs would be lost. You know, but we in the course of dealing with this put all the concerns that civil society organizations had placed before us, and the merging parties kind of agreed that they'd honor union agreements, they'd abide by our labor law, and they would source products locally to to the same extent that they did so prior to the merger. However, there were serious objections from three government departments and two trade unions and an organization representing SMMEs. So subsequently then, you're all aware that the tribunal also approved the merger with conditions that were tendered by the parties, and it's interesting the kind of arguments they made in approving the merger. The big issue here of the parties that are objecting to the decisions of the competition authorities is the weight that the competition authorities gave to the public interest concerns compared to the competition concerns. So we found there was no competition concerns, but parties felt that, look, you know, you find there's no competition concerns, but these public interest concerns are so big and weighty that they should have tipped the balance on the side of us not approving the merger. And the tribunal, in its approval, kind of made some important points about this and said, look, you know, these policy objectives that government departments and unions are wanting to advance may well be legitimate, and in fact, you know, legitimate policy issues. Indeed, they might be necessary for us to pursue. They might be vital for a strong economy in South Africa. But you know, if these issues, however, are not merger specific, all of these problems that are being raised by the objectors are not problems that will result as a consequence of this merger. There are problems that exist in any event, you know, around South Africa's ability to procure and logistics systems and manufacturing capacity, that none of these problems will arise as a direct consequence of this merger. They have existed in any event. And that's the one big principle that they put forward. And they said, look, you know, we can take action in merger regulation around issues like this if the problem is merger specific, if it's related to the specific merger, and if it's substantial, if it's big enough, then it'll outweigh. But in these instances, none of these objections were very merger specific, nor were they substantial enough for us to give them more weighting, and tribunal was very clear that we're not saying these are bad policy objectives, but you need to be using other, perhaps more appropriate policy instruments to achieve these than using the merger control provisions of the competition law. Needless to say, and as you all might be aware, this is a matter that is currently taken on appeal before the Competition Appeal Court, which will be heard before this in this month, I think in the next week, and we'll wait and see what that court has to say about this. The other very, very interesting merger that we've decided on in the year under consideration, and where hearings were only held in the current year, in fact they finished about 2-3 weeks ago, was a merger in the seed market. Okay, so these are agricultural seeds planted for agricultural production, and this was a merger between Pioneer Hybrid and Panar Seeds. Now, in maize seeds in particular, this was the most problematic market because South Africa's maize growing country, and of course, mealie meal is a staple food in South Africa. There are currently, absent the merger, three companies that produce and sell seeds in South Africa: Monsanto, Pioneer Hybrid, and Panar Seeds. I've just got a note that says the tribunal has prohibited the Pioneer-Panar merger. That just happened today now. Okay. So they confirmed our recommendation. Our recommendation is to prohibit it. Okay. So this is hot off our decision. Yeah. So this is hot off the press. So this is important, right? So So why was this merger problematic? There were three players before the merger selling Macy's. When the merger, after the merger, there would be only two. The first and second largest are Monsanto and Pioneer Hybrid. Both of these are American multinational companies. Panar Seeds is a South African company that has a unique germplasm. Germplasm is the genetic material in the seeds that make it unique to South Africa. So, you know, all kind of seeds, some seeds grow better in a particular climate, under particular rainfall, temperature, etc. And all the seeds they had were South African. It's part of, you know, part of our heritage, if you like. These are seeds that kind of developed here for centuries. And so number two was buying off number three. And they were making a lot of what they call pro-competitive and efficiency gain arguments. They were saying things like, look, it's better to have two strong competitors than three players in the market where one is strong and the other two are not so effective as competitors. Better to have two good, effective competitors than three. They were making a lot of arguments like that. And we found that, look, you know, some of these arguments could well be true, but we were not ultimately persuaded that they outweighed all the negative consequences of having just two players supplying South African farmers with seed. Okay? And we said, prohibit this merger. And the hearings were at the tribunal, as I said, 2 weeks ago, ended about 2 weeks ago, and we've heard hot off the press now that the tribunal has indeed prohibited this merger, which was good news for us, for South Africa, I mean. Okay. Now, the other major area of our work is advocacy. This is where we try to influence policy and legislation. We've done a lot of work on that around procurement and supply chain management, and we've kind of commented on some bills in Parliament, amongst them the animal feed bill. We also had a supermarket inquiry. This was not a case. It was not a prosecution. It was an inquiry. We just wanted to know what the problems were. And arising out of the inquiry, we identified problems which we the inquiry didn't give us the kinds of evidence that that will enable us to embark on a prosecution before a court. In other words, it wasn't like the kind of evidence wasn't as overwhelming or didn't meet the standards of the kinds of evidence we require to win these cases. But there were things we were concerned about, and we are speaking to supermarkets around this issue. The big issue we were concerned about there were about exclusive leases that supermarkets have in shopping complexes. So, if you go to any shopping complex, you're likely to find only one big supermarket there as an anchor tenant. You'll never find like Checkers and Pick and Pay next to each other. There's one. So that's excluded. So Pick and Pay will say, look, I'll only be a tenant here if you don't allow my competitor to also be here, because I don't want the competition. That's one issue. But over and above that, they don't even want like a local small greengrocer or a local small, you know, shop that, in other words, they want to exclude everybody who sells the products they sell. They don't even want sometimes a bottle store because they have an in-house bottle store, or a bakery if they have one, an in-house bakery. You know, it's to that extent that they want to exclude competitors from the shopping center. And we're saying, look, you know, we want you to stop having leases, these kind of exclusive leases. And this is something we're doing through engagement with them. The third and perhaps most important issue around procurement is work we've done on bid rigging and procurement. Now, the fast track settlement is a major part of that work, and that's the enforcement side of our work. That's where we're prosecuting people who broke the law. We're finding the bad guys, in other words, and prosecuting them. But in addition to that, you know, in order to really deal with this issue of bid rigging, fair enough, you catch the bad guys, but we also need to strengthen our own systems to prevent this from happening going forward. we do it as we've targeted the procuring department, so the department that procure more, like the Department of Health in the case of medicines. And, you know, we've targeted the procuring department to run this with them. We've also collaborated with Palama, where we've, together with them, have now put together a curriculum for training public sector officials on good drinking. So all public sector officials are now going through a Palama training course with a module on good drinking and what it is and how to prevent it and how to ensure it doesn't happen. And we've worked with National Treasury to National Treasury has put out, in terms of the PFMA, a circular, a circular saying that all companies that bid for a government tender must sign a certificate of independent bid determination. They've now incorporated this into the tender process, and this certificate says makes a declaration that I did not collude with anybody in making my tender to for this job. So it's like a signed undertaking. You know, one might be skeptical about, well, what will that change? But what that does is it enables us to criminally prosecute a breach of the certificate of independent bid determination. So, not the commission, of course, but, you know, in other words, if you sign something with the procuring department, you've broken that contract, as it were, you could be prosecuted criminally. So it's not just for show, it's something that can be followed up and enforced in that way. And so through a range of these activities, we're kind of dealing with the issue of public procurement in a very multi-pronged way. You know, we're investigating and catching out the bad guys, we're training the government officials to ensure that they are up to speed on how to tackle this issue and prevent it from happening, and we're getting all future tenders, we're tightening up the process to get commitments from parties or tender that they will not, that they have not been involved in any collusive activities in coming up with their bids. The Commission continues to be involved in a lot of international work. We've participated in international forums, policy-making type forums, where people are very, very interested in the work that we're doing. They find our system to be very innovative. We get a lot of space in public platforms internationally to explain what we do and how we do it. And while we're involved in international forums like the ICN, the OECD, and UNCTAD, in truth, in the last period, as we kind of reported, I think, when we came to present our plans, is we concentrated more in collaboration with other African countries. We were integrally involved in launching the African Competition Forum, of which I was elected vice chair of the steering committee. My Kenyan counterpart is the chairperson, and that's something this is a kind of forum where competition officials from all the different African countries can get together to share experiences and build capacity and learn from each other and kind of just develop a more African approach on how we tackle some of these issues. We've also, in addition to that, kind of worked bilaterally with a number of different countries. An interesting project was a joint food project we had with Zambia and Egypt, where we shared our ideas around how we worked through our different cases in the food markets, and this was mostly to kind of develop capacities around methodologies to do research and to gather information. And so we shared ways in which we went about kind of gathering and analyzing information in these markets. We've also had, we sent, for example, to both Mauritius and Namibia staff from the commission that went, and in the case of Namibia, two of our staff members were there for 3 months. And that was assisting the Namibians to kind of put together their cases. It was real hands-on training. We kind of getting good at doing these hands-on knowledge transfers rather than just having a workshop and somebody come in and listen. So our guys went there and worked on real cases and helped them take their cases forward. We also get a lot of people coming to us. We've had, I think, people from Mauritius come to us for an extended period of, for, I think, 2-3 months. And we've hosted delegations of very senior people who come to see how the organization works from Kenya, Botswana, and Namibia. And we also participate both in SACU and SADC on competition matters. Our communication work is something that we continue to do, both internal communication and external. We've put a lot of effort into ensuring the organization itself, as it grows, there's good internal communication, both not only on administrative issues like staff leave and, you know, issues of HR and admin, but on issues around cases. So we have, when there's an interesting case, we get the staff together and the people involved in it will brief them on what has happened, and so everybody is kept abreast of the work we're doing, both in terms of content, and our staff meetings perhaps deals with the more administrative issues. And so keeping staff informed of our work is a big part of it. And then externally, we produce newsletters, we've our media statements, on the website you'll be familiar with. We do lots of interviews with journalists. We get a fair amount of media coverage, and our website is very successful. I mean, I think, 34,000 visitors in a year is, I think, admirable for a website. In some methodology used by a media company, we received 153 million rands worth of advertising through just media coverage. Our human resources remain the most important part of our organization, because we are, a lot of our people are intellectual workers, if you like. They're lawyers and economists, and they're analyzing, and that's our biggest resource, our people, and our staff is steadily increasing in size, 163 compared to 138 last year. We continue with our graduate trainee program. We have 14 graduate trainees under review. These are people, these are students just out of university, their first job, and it's proved to us very successful. They contracted with us for a year. Half of them leave, but half of them stay. So we kind of use our graduate trainee program as a training ground as well for new people in what is a very new area, I think, in academia as well. So we'll get additional staff going forward. We've put together plans around new organizational structures that are going to be submitted to EDD for approval. We have a number of many learning and development opportunities and interventions in the organization. And we've had, in the year under review, a management development program, the second year, the second run of it. We had the first one the previous year, where we are training mid-level managers on management skills, project management skills. You appreciate that a lot of people that come to work with us are perhaps very, very good lawyers and very good economists, but they don't come with a background in management and training in management. And as they rise up in the organization, that's the skill that we need to develop in that layer for the organization to work better. I think we do, we an organization as a kind of post-1994 organization, I suppose, have never had any major problems around our employment equity, because we kind of, we only started recruiting afresh from post-94, and we didn't have historical issues to deal with. We've put a lot of emphasis on our IT and knowledge management work. You'll see that a lot of our capital expenditure in the current year was in the place of computers, and we've kind of reworked continuously our very important as the organization becomes more and more complex and there's more and more cases. And you know, I can't remember every case, but I'd like to kind of click a few buttons on a computer and be briefed immediately, which is what our knowledge management system will enable us to do. And there's many cases to track, and if you miss deadlines, you know, you're punished in the courts for doing so. So it becomes important for us to track our cases properly, and all of our investment in knowledge management is getting the right technology and software and making sure it's properly catering and, you know, it's kind of customized and what I'm looking for to our needs. And and we need to kind of change, and part of it is changing, there's a kind of bit of a culture change in the organization to get people to use this technology more and more. You can put in technology, but if people are reluctant to using it, it doesn't happen. And so we're also dealing with the cultural issues of getting people to use it and to ensure that it's maintained. In other words, it's updated all the time. So, and that's a big part of our work, I think, in kind of strengthening the way in which the organization works. If you look at our financials, you'll see that we did in this last year get 30 odd million rand more from a government grant. Our government grant has increased. Our fee income, and this is fees we get from merger filings, so when a merger is filed, there's a filing fee that's paid. That didn't increase as dramatically as I think some of us expected, but that has to do with the decrease in merger activity that we spoke about earlier. And in total, our kind of revenue has increased, I think, in the last financial year. If you look at our expenditure, because of the reasons I've explained around our human resources being our biggest asset, most of our money is spent on personnel. Under what comes under operating expenses, there includes legal fees and economic expertise and other kind of operational issues like rent, etc. And there's a diagram showing the relative expenditure as per these different categories. The Commission's corporate governance, the way in which the organization works and takes decisions, is, I think, one of our tricks in running a good organization. It kind of, we ensure that a commission meets once a week, well, 40 weeks out of 52, I think, is regular meetings, ensure decisions are taken. We have to do that because sometimes if we don't take a decision, then the decision is deemed to have been taken. And we've never kind of missed deadlines, very rarely, certainly not in this year, where we didn't take a decision. And if we don't, you know, you can imagine that businesses will be very quick to complain about being slow, etc. So this kind of governing the organization, ensuring quick and good decision making is very important. All these committees play important roles in ensuring the organization works properly. So there's been no kind of our auditors have looked at all of this. Our internal financial controls and systems are in place. We comply with all the legislation, PFMA in terms of reporting to EDD, training, compliance, skills levy fund. We've complied with all of that. We've had an unqualified audit opinion in the financial year under review. Our sixth successive year. There's been no findings on our performance information. The AG did have an emphasis on matter on the non-disclosure of legal counsel expenses. So legal counsel expenses, we talk about lawyers, advocates and attorneys who we hire to assist us with cases. And the issue here was that we had not followed the kind of, the regular procurement process in appointing these lawyers. Okay, there were a number of reasons for that, and we've kind of fixed that. And in other words, even though we'd taken the decision to go a particular route, we hadn't kind of recorded it sufficiently enough, and that's where the real emphasis of matter comes in. Essentially, what's happening here is that, you know, the nature of the services that are provided by lawyers is not something you go out and you get three quotes for. For example, you can't go to three lawyers to hear the case, give me a quote, I'm going to get the cheapest one. The way in which you appoint lawyers is you appoint them on the basis of the particular skills and experience they have. So if you want, you know, if you're doing a constitutional case, you're going to go to the best constitutional lawyer who has some experience. You don't kind of do it in the same way that you say that you're ordering stationery or, you know, other kind of more tangible goods. And in any event, you know, kind of costing a case for lawyers is not something they can do up front. You can't give you a budget up front and say, well, if we take this case, this is how much it's going to cost. Because cases are evolving things that take twists and turns, and so, you know, you can't do it in that way. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, the rules of the lawyer profession, of the lawyers, the legal profession, I think, you know, they claim it doesn't allow them to give you quotes. Yeah, you know, they've got kind of rules that that make it difficult for us to use the proper traditional regular procurement process to work on. So we've been doing this for a while, working in this way. In other words, this was not something that was picked up previously by the AG's office, but when they picked it up, they pointed it out. They pointed the retrospectiveness of it. And we've now kind of changed our system. The system we were working towards, in any event, where we have a database of lawyers and we have a set of rules around how we will go about selecting lawyers, which the AG is happy with and thinks it's a kind of fair process and consistent with. And I would have to kind of personally sign off at the end of the appointment. So we've put kind of checks and balances in the system to ensure that procurement occurs properly. Okay. So I think that was the only kind of issue that came up in terms of our audit. But another big issue is my final slide that we have taken very, very seriously in the organization is the issue of risk management. This is something that the AG and National Treasury emphasizes, that risk management is something government departments are not doing sufficiently. And of course, apart from there being a rule saying we must do that, we have a genuine interest in ensuring that we manage our risks properly, because a lot depends on the work we're doing, and especially some of the kind of bad experiences we've had with adverse court decisions in the recent past. We've taken this very seriously, and we now have a risk committee separate from the audit committee, whereas previously the audit committee dealt with risk as one of the agenda items. We've taken it out and have dedicated risk committee, and we continuously look at what are the risks facing the organization. And in the period under review, the five top risks were the unmanageable caseload relative to staff complement. In other words, if we're unable to increase our staff and human resources in tandem and in relation to the number of cases, the organization is going to become completely unmanageable, and that's going to result in a problem. With respect to, you know, particularly issues related to the Walmart matter and other controversial decisions we've taken, we see reputational harm to the institution as being a big risk, and the independence of the institution potentially being undermined as one of the risk factors that could lead to reputational harm. Possible under or overspending is something that we take seriously and a lot of the governance issues we've put into place, mechanisms to ensure that doesn't happen. adverse decisions from the courts and powers and procedures of the commission, if we are unable to win those in the constitutional court, will pose a great risk to the organization's ability to successfully prosecute cases. And finally, a point that we've made previously, and I see has come up, has been declared by UDD from what I read in the newspaper, is one of our biggest risks is, in terms of capacity right now, is the question of office space, which is an issue you're familiar with, I think, from previous years and from UDD's reports. That's my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramburu. I guess the presentation is quite clear, and would just like to thank you, actually, and congratulate you for the unqualified report, although noting the matters of emphasis. I guess I'll repeat what I said also to the tribunal yesterday, that irregular matters are irregular matters, and unless you correct them, they will remain likewise. We do understand, we will, when we meet with the AG next week, try to perhaps look at that point that you are raising around the legal practitioners. That was my understanding too, but just to try and understand his own thinking around the reason why they decided to make it an irregular practice. Yeah, I think if it has to do with the way or the means applied, it's something that perhaps can be corrected by yourself. But if it's general practice issue, then it's another issue. Let me then open the presentation for discussion. Babuntuli.
Thanks, Chairperson. I was going to suggest, Chair, what if we just pose questions and then they respond after lunch or after break, because we are so pressed. If we can check that.
Can I respond to that? Are we intending to come back? Because I thought we're going to finish everything and then get released afterwards. I'm taking into consideration your consent, your earlier consent.
A comfort break, because as we are two here, then if you go out.
I can't hear you. Please talk to the mic.
I'm saying, because of the numbers, at least maybe a comfort break, then we do some. But I was saying, or then if there is a problem, then I don't mind. The other thing, Chair. Is that the commissioner is using a bedroom voice, and you feel as if you are...
Oh, your ears are very strained, yeah. Something I had
to get what... Okay. All right, yeah. Thanks, Chair. I'm saying we know that sometimes, particularly with the mergers, that we are dealing with people who've got money, and we have heard that some of them are saying they can pay penalty every day and continue doing as usual, as long as they get their profits. So it is something where we need, I think it's very serious. So I was checking whether, as parliamentarians or as parliament, we're supposed to make laws so that the judiciary interprets or they judicate. But it seems as if we all want the judiciary to make our decisions, what Parliament is supposed to do? I mean, what is your advice to say, how can we assist the Competition Commission to correct the loopholes so that we don't wait for the appeal courts to do all this, but we know that as Parliament we are ready, we have done this, so it is tight, it won't need to go. Because if you look at, maybe I'll ask the other question, let's say if you lose, who pays? Who pays for the cost if you lose, I mean, against these big companies? So that's number one, Chair, if we can be able to be taken through on that, whether don't we need, as Parliament, we need to tighten up the laws so that it's tight. Why was under expenditure, or is it justified that you were, why you under expend? And then it's always it's like yesterday, this question of public interest and the anti-competitiveness. We did ask that question as well, and we wanted to check the after effect. Let's say you have made a mistake here and you say they must merge, because sometimes they don't reveal that the merger is going to have consequences of retrenchment, and you find that after they merge, then like this Walmart who was not agreeing, they say no, they can keep it for 3 years, but after that it means then obviously they are going to retrench. Is it possible to foresee that no, we cannot, because as the time goes on there, or we say, or we can say we will continue making conditions like the ministers have applied to the appeal. Lastly, Chair, is the, you know, we always talk about the co-ops to say, as the government, as we can see that there's so much unemployment, can't we ring fence the procurement for the government to say, this is not going to go for tender, it's going just for these people, for these people who are staying around here to produce food for the for this hospital, to produce blankets for this hospital, to produce this, and instead of opening the tender, and then it's obvious then these people would won't be able to supply these public entities. So I'm checking that against the competition to say now, because these greedy companies will say no, let's tender so that we supply. Instead, I'm just checking that country as the government to say no, we put aside, it's not for tender, these are for the co-ops. Then we help those co-ops to be able to supply. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Nice work, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I was saying to Mr. Ramburu earlier on that when it comes to Competition Commission, we just sing praise of songs and summon the meeting again. We compose songs, you know, songs of praise, but Comrade Bob is not here. He's the best person to do that. Under legal services, on the commission's ability to initiate and investigate complaints, we see this as tampering with their powers to fight for the victims, because it's not in favor of the consumer, the ultimate person who pays for whatever cost is there. And for some of us, that's what we get paid for, to fight for those people who cannot fight for themselves. And if the commission only deals with the initial cost of the investigation, I'm not sure how does the collusion differ with corruption. Because in corruption cases, you know, only one person will be implicated, but at the end of the investigation, we have a number of people being implicated. So I'm not sure how does this one differ from that one. You know, you also know about your investment in Switzerland. It was about corruption in government. So I don't know how does this one differ you as well. And on human resource, the graduate trainees, the 14, if we can get information in relation to gender and race and institutions, where they come from. We had a number of questions here, but as the presentation, you know, went on, some of them were already answered, so I'm trying to keep those. Yeah, also to appreciate the fact that you have 6 successive years for unqualified good opinion. Maybe one of these days, maybe next year, when President is dealing with some awards, competition commission will be considered. And on the separation of this committee and audit committee, how do you separate them? I mean, why? We take it that they augment one another. How do they function being separated from one another? And the other one, I think, Mr. Ntuli has alluded to already. I will not repeat them, like the one Chairperson has alluded to about the irregular. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Tessich. With this interest, keen interest, Mr. Ramburu, I just want to understand what influences your prioritization. I'm also interested to understand, I think it's a follow-up to Babuntuli's question also. It's an addition around the settlement. I just want to find out the Pioneer settlement. Do you have any influence in terms of where and which areas do they target? Or is it left to the Department of Agriculture or to the EDD in terms of identification and of both of participants and in terms of the areas? That's geographic areas. I'm not sure as to the issue of the fast track settlement. Was it last year or early this year where you presented a number of cases under construction? I'm not sure how far in terms of those cases. Yes, in terms of settlement, it's something else. In terms of the leniency issues, it's something else. But I just want to know how far are you with those that are not in the area. The measures, in terms of the measures, I can see that you focus in, you're more successful, or there's been application in the intermediate more and more in the, you know, large or bigger companies. I just want to understand, what does that mean to our country, especially in as far as small business is concerned? What does IP stand for?
Intellectual.
Oh, intellectual property. Okay. Pardon me, I've just put set up the 5% provision for possibility of not succeeding. Why 5%? Does that not influence the way your effort into particular cases, for instance? I just want to find out on that one. And I think the other question was asked by Obabuntu. You said you took the issue around powers to the Concord. The legal advice here says the Concord seems to deals with constitutional matters, and then wants to know how then is this going to influence cases or the matter that the cases that you've referred, for instance. Do they have constitutional base? I heard you saying, for instance, yes, in terms of ordinary people, you know, applying, it means that will discourage them from applying, and it means that most of their cases will be challenged, and they might end up losing faith in the competition commission and so forth. But do you have a case on that? Yes, I just want to find out. Is there anything, for instance, because last time you came, you informed us that the amendment bill was assented to by the president, but we heard yesterday from Mr. Manon that it was not promulgated. Do you know what are the reasons for that? And to what extent does that impact on your work? And have you, yeah, maybe if you respond, I'll be able to have a follow up. In terms of your consulting fees, Mr. Ramburu, they've increased threefold. What is the reason? Between 5 to 15 million? Are the reasons some of the reasons you gave, or are the reasons that led to your to the AG putting a matter of emphasis as an irregular? Yeah, I think those would be the questions. Thank you.
No more bedroom voice. Okay, so I mean, the question, the important question is, if all these laws are being interpreted in a way that's contrary to what we expect and what our objectives are, what is the role of, you know, is there any role for lawmakers here, or Parliament, for example, and what are the loopholes? Look, I think that's a very hard question to answer, because I think I'm, and this might well be a cynical view from my part, is that it's sure there are certain aspects of law that can be written more clearly. And we have found instances in the Competition Act where, you know, if this was written more clearly, it would place us in a better position to use it or to understand what it means. So there is that, and one has to look at case by case where that does occur. But I think, you know, and this is a cynical view, I think no matter how you write the law, you're going to get some clever lawyer that interprets, you know, you put two clever lawyers in the room and they'll interpret it differently. I think there's, by the very nature of that profession and how the law works, that necessarily does happen. But I think that what happens with laws is, over time, as jurisprudence develops, as courts take more and more decisions, it is through United States, what they call antitrust law. There were different, you know, a lot of the U.S. has had laws for over 100 years, and in different periods in history, those laws, the same words meant different things, and they kind of got changed over time. And I think that's the nature of kind of, you know, jurisprudence and how laws get interpreted. You get clarity over time. So, I mean, that's the answer to that question as best I can do. I'm going to ask Wendy to pick up on any of these questions that she thinks she wants to add to. Chair, the constitutional basis is precisely what you've said. It is the rights of the constitutional point is that the decision of the High Court, of the Supreme Court of Appeal, is undermining of a complainant's right to complain, and that is a constitutional issue. So that's the constitutional point.
Yes. Just a follow up on that. But others would say, for instance, you have set up your complaint process in a very haphazard manner, not in a very structured manner, and that led then to, you know, you not being able to win. What would you say if it comes up like that? That it is not because the plight of the applicants would want to be challenged, but it's because of the way the Competition Commission itself handles its own cases. You're not sort of organized. Yes.
Yeah,
I'm just putting it.
I think that the what the decisions say don't criticize so much the how a complaint can be filed, because that's detailed in the Competition Act. The Act specifies, firstly, how we as the Commission can start an investigation. It also specifies what a complainant needs to do. So file a form and then complete a document explaining what you're complaining. Basically, the form is a summary of what the complaint is, and then you can attach a description of conduct where you go into detail about what the complaint is. Now, the issues that are arising in the cases are around the content of the complaint. So, for example, we as the Commission will say, or what would happen in the ordinary course is a complainant, a company can come and say, I've just discovered that my supplier, who is the only person I can buy a particular item from, sells to me at a price that's different to my competitor. And that means that because I pay higher than what my competitor does, I can't compete effectively. So the decisions of the court have said he doesn't have to specify and say, look, that's price discrimination, so he doesn't need to know that. But if in his complaint he adds further and says, you know, I think that the reason that this is happening is because, you know, there's collusion, for example. But he's not complaining about that. We as the Commission cannot investigate. Now, the issue that the Commissioner touched on earlier was that you may find when a complainant comes to complain to us, he doesn't actually know. He doesn't know what the reason for the price discrimination, and in fact may not really know whether it's real price discrimination that's taking place. All he's complaining of is his understanding of the conduct that's taking place in the market. Now, what we are saying is we as the Commission should be able to conduct a full investigation into that complaint. We understand that the complainant is a person who doesn't understand competition law. He comes to complain about his experience of the conduct in the market, and we should then have latitude to investigate that complaint and determine why, you know, what is giving rise to what he has complained of. We can't be expected, neither should a complainant be expected, to know at the time that we file a complaint or that he submits a complaint, to know what's the reason for
and the outcomes he experiences in the market are. Now, the decisions are drawing a link and saying, well, if he submits a complaint and he says, well, I'm being charged more than my competitor, if the complaint says I'm being charged more than my competitor, what we as the commission should refer is a complaint that deals only with why he's being charged more than the competitor. If we uncover during the investigation that there's something else that's giving rise to the conduct, we can't refer it unless we initiate afresh. Now, one might say, so why can't you do that as the commission? We say it gives rise to inefficiency in the system because it can cause a situation where we must take over the complaint. And if we take over the complaint, we limit some of the rights that a complainant has in terms of the act. So when he comes to lodge a complaint to us, he has the right to also go to the tribunal and say, in the meantime, while the commission investigates this complaint, please prevent my supplier from charging me a higher price. Now, if we hijack, and I think that's the term that the tribunal uses in a recent decision, if we take over the complaint because his complaint hasn't detailed everything, we compromise his rights to that interim relief. So there's a balancing issue here that is not necessarily about process, because no one is saying that the process that's mandated in the Act is problematic. It's about content. So how much detail should be in the complaint, and what should the Commission do in the course of investigating that complaint if it finds out that the reason for the problems or the outcome that the complainant is complaining about is different or is more than what the complainant has complained of? Should we go back and keep amending the complaints? In certain instances, that becomes problematic because there's a provision in the Act that provides that we can't investigate conduct that stopped more than 3 years ago. So if we find out that there are certain parties, say if it was a cartel, and at the time the complaint came, they only mentioned two parties. If we find out that there were other parties, there is potentially a loophole for the other parties to escape if we only find out about their involvement, you know, down the line. And yet at the time we start the investigation, we don't know. We don't know what is happening. We are simply saying the content of what should go into our complaint initiation and into what a complainant is expected to tell us to enable us to do the investigation. The standard should not be set so high that we then can't conduct the investigation. So the issues really are not so much about our processes flawed. Yeah.
But the criticism is around the process. Because they say it's the one that really leads to. Because yesterday, for instance, with the tribunal, they are in support of your case in the Constitutional Court, because they say the whatever precedent that has been created by the court, they ought to follow, because that's how they operate. So unless your case is resolved, they'll continue to do that, and many people are going to lose. I don't have a problem. Then the problem that I have is after, for instance, the tribunal has said, no, let's drop this because of this technicality. What do you do? Does it mean you stop everything and to following up and to correct that technicality? Are you allowed? Are you not allowed to do so? Why did you even have to go through that process of the Concord?
So the idea of going to the Constitutional Court is to for it to give clarity. So are these standards? The outcome basically we want is for the Constitutional Court to give a view on firstly how the statute has been crafted, and whether or not it's been appropriately interpreted in terms of the standard that's been set for our complaint initiations and for complaints that are filed by third parties.
and really at the heart of the cases is, are these standards such as to deny, in the case of third-party complainants, their rights of access to justice and to have their complaints determined? If the standard is set so high that you prevent the investigation of complaints, because what it means is that a complainant must have all the facts, put them before the very body that has the duty of investigating. If that results in a technicality that prevents even the investigation, then firstly, are we undermining their right to have that complaint investigated? And secondly, are we not defeating the very purpose for which this institution was set up? So that's the constitutional issue for the Constitutional Court to resolve. If they come back and they say, well, we think all these decisions are correct, and the problem is because of the way the statute has been interpreted, or the way which, if we're balancing constitutional rights of respondents to due process vis-a-vis the mandate of the Competition Act, then we will know that it's something we can come back to you as the legislature and say we need to relook at the statute and tighten it up so that it properly balances those two interests. At the moment, we are saying that we believe the statute is it doesn't restrict, it doesn't warrant the restrictive interpretation that's been decided by the courts in recent months, and that you as the Concord can give the direction, because within the statute as it's crafted, we think that the decisions are setting a standard which is restrictive and unduly high and results in denial of third party complainants' right to have complaints investigated. Well, I mean, if we waited for the long appellate processes, what would actually happen is that, you know, currently some cases, one case, in fact, the SAD case, would have had to go firstly to the Competition Appeal Court. The Competition Appeal Court would not be able to rule differently from what the Supreme Court of Appeal has decided. So precedent would actually send us all the way back. We wouldn't resolve the issue because the tribunal is bound to apply whatever decision the Competition Appeal Court has handed down. The Competition Appeal Court is bound by the decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal. And we are saying that the problem starts with the Supreme Court of Appeal's ruling, at least in one of the cases, and then the further problematic manner in which the Competition Appeal Court itself has interpreted that decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal. So in essence, what it means is any case that would come before the tribunal, they would be bound to apply these decisions, and we ultimately would have an unworkable system where we can't do anything. We need the Constitutional Court itself to determine the issues. Then we have guidance, because ultimately every case would be determined on what we say in our assessment are wrong precedents of courts, wrong decisions of courts which set precedent, which is therefore binding on both ourselves and the Competition Tribunal.
And I mean, you know, there are and there's detail here as well, because, you know, as the precedent comes down, so we've got all these other cases following it, and, you know, if we have to take each of these cases through all the respective courts to get to the Constitutional Court, knowing what their decisions will be, because the precedent's already set, it's just going to take forever. So we making a strong case in asking the Constitutional Court to hear us, to say, look, this is the implication, this is what it would mean, and therefore, you know, we think you should give us a hearing right off on this. Now, whether we'll win that or not, I don't know. I think those courts are reluctant to get people to get bypassing the process, but we have a really good case. In other words, we, you know, there's, what, 12 odd cases we'll have to kind of wait for years to fix. Markets would have changed by then. There would have been new players in the markets. Markets are rapidly changing things. And we would end up, in 10 years' time, fighting an issue that's 20 years old, we don't want to do that. You know, it's just kind of, it's just going to take too long. We'd rather be responding to new issues as they come up than, you know, quite frankly, it would be wiser to abandon these cases altogether. So, you know, I mean, the two points to emphasize in terms of what Wendy has said is one of the problems of these courts, one of the conceptual problems is when they're balancing these rights, they feel very strongly about these rights of these businesses that are being kind of harassed, if you like, in inverted commas, by this public agency that's fining them a lot of high amounts of money. So they're seeing businesses on one side and they're seeing the Competition Commission as the public agency on the other. That's not the case. The two sides is business on one side and consumers on the other. And the courts are completely silent as to balancing the rights of consumers who are our complainants. They kind of casting it as a bad public agency that's not following procedure properly. And a lot of people have told us, well, why don't you just follow the procedure? Well, we do follow the procedure. I mean, if you look at that little book, most of it is about step by step what procedure we follow. This is a different kind of thing. And a nice analogy that somebody wrote in the newspaper is that this is like, you know, a patient going to a doctor and saying to the doctor, look, I've got an ache in my stomach, it's appendicitis, right? So the doctor examines him, and the doctor only looks for appendicitis. The guy might have stomach cancer, but the doctor is not allowed to look at anything else. And he says, no, you don't. My job is only to tell you don't have appendicitis, go home. And so we like the doctor. We need to look more broadly at what the problem is. Okay, the problem is not appendicitis, but, you know, we found another problem here, and we need to treat this other problem. So that's a better analogy, I think, around what's happening with these cases. Chair, I can very quickly go through the remaining questions. I think your question about costs is that costs do get awarded against the commission. So if we lose this case, we would have to pay costs. But a lot of the cases that we've already lost, we liable to pay costs for them in any event. This is the last step. If we win the last step cases, then we're not eligible to pay all the costs of the cases we lost below. Okay? So in other words, it's kind of worth our while to do that one final step, and even if we lose it, we'll pay a little more costs, sure. But if we win it, we'll pay no costs for all the other cases we lost in getting up to that point. Why? Insofar as we've underspent, the underspending comes from primarily the fast track settlement project, which we put together and designed in the year under review, and we got additional funding for that project. So we applied for additional funding for the project. We had meetings around, you know, we got two ministers to a meeting to explain to them what we're doing and got their blessings to do that. The difficulty arose when that money came in late, and, you know, it came, we were uncertain about whether we'd receive, what was it, 21 million? 28 million. We were uncertain right up to the last minute, so we hadn't started the project. Only when we got the money in did we start, so we kind of started that project. Although everything was set up, we started it late, so we couldn't spend all that money. The question around, you know, public interest and putting a time limit on or parties saying, look, you know, only for the next 3 years we won't retrench. The thing about the law of mergers is that if you're analyzing a merger, you can only impose conditions on a party that are related to that merger. The point I made earlier about merger specificity. And it's most likely that anything that happens after 3 years is not going to be
absolutely merger specific, because a whole range of things would have happened in that intervening 3 years that would have changed things and thereby not made that action. You know, after 3 years, it would be, I think, unreasonable to, although it's not impossible, but it would be unreasonable and unlikely that something happening is merger specific or something that occurred 3 years ago. So you can't kind of hold a company, for example, to take it to the other extreme, to some behavior for all times going forward. You only can address the issues that arise out specifically out of that merger. You know, your question about whether we can, whether procurement, kind of designing procurement for only particular classes of people, in your instance, say co-ops, and you kind of ring fence it and only ask for co-op. You know, that's a policy issue that I think, you know, parliamentarians, policymakers are entitled to take. They would have to justify it in the normal course. It could, so in other words, they would have to argue that there's a certain public interest here that makes it really, really important for us to only offer this to a particular class of people, or individuals, or firms. And if that case is made, they could go ahead. Even the chances are that those will be anti-competitive. In other words, that, you know, pro-competitive is where you get the best deal, where you get the cheapest price, the best quality, the fastest turnaround time. And if you want, if so, your objective in that procurement is important. And most people are procuring anything, are procuring it for the use of a third party. And their primary interest is the interest and welfare of that third party. So if you apply, if you're procuring HIV drugs, for example, your primary thing is, I must make these drugs as cheapest for the people with HIV. It's very rare in a procurement process that the interests of the procurer, the person supplying, outweighs the interests of the person who's receiving something. You know, take a ridiculous example on HIV. Is you're not going to say, well, you know, my main objective in procuring HIV drugs is to boost small business, or to boost co-ops. That wouldn't make sense. You know, if your main interest in the procurement of HIV is in the interest of the supplier, usually in most instances your main interest is in the interest of the receiver of that good and service. The point about legal services initiating complaints and this being, you know, the point around how it disadvantages the complainant, I think has been dealt with, and that is the point that we're making. Precisely your point, I think, is what we're making. I don't have the figures for the gender and race breakdown for you. You know, so that's 14 people, gender, race of our graduate trainees. I don't have that breakdown, which institutions they come from, offhand. But it's something we can easily give to you. The question of the audit and the risk thing, yes, certainly. I mean, all we've done here is, whereas previously risk was one agenda item on an audit committee meeting, what we've done now is we set up a subcommittee of the audit committee to deal specifically with risk. So it's not separated from the audit committee. You're absolutely right that there must be interaction between those two areas. What's the difference between do you want to answer that? You can answer that, right? What influences our prioritization? Well, I mean, I think that you know, we've put a lot of thought into this. Was the major kind of strategic planning issue that our institution went through, and in my view, it was the kind of one thing we did that kind of got us becoming more effective in a very short period of time.
So in other words, instead of trying to do everything and do a little of everything, we asked ourselves, what are the most important issues to tackle? And how do we work out what are the most important issues to tackle? And so we work out a set of criteria. We said, clearly, we need to tackle issues in markets that affect poor people. So food markets, pharmaceutical drug markets, those are the more important things, clearly. We also looked at, in prioritizing, we looked at our past experience and said, well, where are most of the complaints coming from? What are people complaining about most? And we analyzed what our past history of past investigation and complaints, and we said that must be factored into how we prioritize. We also prioritized in terms of government policy, where we said, well, what are our industrial policy objectives, what is the growth objectives of this country, and how could we as an institution play a role in advancing those. So for example, you know, intermediate industrial products is something that comes directly from that thinking. I mean, the major analysis of why South Africa's manufacturing industry has not developed to any large extent is because inputs into manufacturing is so high. It's the cost of steel, the cost of chemicals, these are all very high. And unless we bring those costs down, you're not going to get a manufacturing industry developing. So that was a big factor. Yeah, and finally, a factor that we kind of considered, I think, as well, was the cost of doing business. What makes it difficult for businesses to come and operate? And clearly, our cases around bank charges, our cases around telecommunication costs, has to do with the cost of doing business. I mean, particularly small businesses who, if you kind of add up your bank charges at the end of the month, they kind of come to quite an appreciable amount, as with your telephony costs. So those were the factors that we have considered, and our kind of strategic planning document outlines the logic of the thinking on how we arrived at the priority sectors. There was a question about the settlement of Pioneer and on whether we have any influence on which areas this fund will target. Well, the fund is to be administered by the Industrial Development Corporation. They have already worked with us quite closely and will continue to in putting together this fund, because it's through information that we gathered and we analyzed that this fund came into being. It was our view that, look, one of the ways of tackling, of making these sectors more competitive is to have new players entering it. And essentially, I think we will have an influence around how the fund is structured and what criteria is used in awarding this finance to prospective applicants. I think that's the work that needs to be done. What are the qualifying criteria to get access to this fund? And we will, I think, have some input on that. But the IDC does this sort of thing as a matter of course. This is what they do. This is actually their greater area of expertise. We will give them whatever information we have. With respect to the question around Fast Track, yes, it is true. In addition to the Fast Track, we've had a number of cases in many product markets. Remember, the Fast Track is for bid rigging, is for collusive tendering. So we've had a number of cases in product markets, from steel, wire, bricks, cement, a whole range of cases. Some of them we've settled, some of them are still continuing. The big ones we've reported on, the big case that's coming up next, there are already settlement discussions, is around cement cartel. That's a case that I think will conclude in this current financial year, clearly, well, hopefully. But we kind of, a lot of the cases, I can't tell you offhand, perhaps Wendy, if you want to know, I think look at current and previous annual reports and we can piece that together. You could piece it together, but we can give it to you one off as well. The 5% possibility of not succeeding, I think that is I think that's very ambitious. Personally, I think it's ambitious. I mean, I think, you know, in the normal course, any litigant has, for every case, a 50-50 chance. I think we would set ourselves higher standards around this, precisely because I think we do prioritize. So we not, you know, sometimes fair enough. It's good to fight the good fight, win or lose. And you say, I'm going to tackle this issue. Doesn't matter if I win or lose, it's a good fight. You know, we have to, it raises consciousness, and even if we lose, you know, in the broader scheme of things, but we are, under the kind of resource constraints we have, we are really kind of incentivized to choose winning cases, to make, and choosing winning cases, you don't choose them up front, you know, that all of this has to do with the quality of evidence you get and the quality of your investigations. And so a number of cases, even in the priority sectors where we've investigated, we found there was not sufficient evidence to prosecute such a case. We've said, okay, we're not going to take it any further. But the cases we do take further are cases that we feel more confident by. But if your point is that we are too ambitious, I agree with you. I think that 95% is too ambitious. With respect to the amendment bill, look, I don't have any further information on this from what we've already reported to you previously. I mean, I think there is one of the implications. The only thing, if you know the kind of history and our view on these cases, on this on the policy process and the you know, this kind of bill that's been assented to and not promulgated, is, I mean, the only thing that we would have still find to be the most helpful and useful thing is the market inquiry provision, because that gives us powers to understand and market more broadly than in a kind of prosecutorial adversarial sense of a case, you know, where you're investigating a case because on the other side there's somebody who broke the law. In a market inquiry, you get a deeper understanding without kind of wanting to know who broke the law, and it has a lot of value in policy making. And interestingly, the Department of Health and the Minister of Health is very keen for us to use our powers to do a market inquiry into costs of private health care, which we would find, you know, we would be amenable to doing. We think that's a good idea, and we would want the powers that the amendment would give us to enable us to do that. There are other aspects of this bill which, and as you know, this is perhaps one of the reasons it's been held up, which many constituencies and stakeholders find to be unconstitutional, and I think it would be it would be unfair for the competition for legislation to be passed and then given to the competition authorities to implement, and then it's found to be unconstitutional. That would just tie us up in unnecessary litigation, fighting points of law for a very long period of time, and not kind of making meaningful use of these provisions. We'll just get caught up in litigation going forward around the constitutionality of these provisions, rather than using them to achieve the kind of outcomes we want from them. With respect to consultant fees, the question is why they're so high. They're high for a number of reasons. One is, as you saw in the graph, the number of contested cases before the tribunal and courts have increased dramatically. So what that means is more lawyers to be paid, more economic experts. You know, a lot of these cases are a very specific, unique markets, and there's some expert in the world who knows everything about about the biotechnology market, which we won't have in-house. We necessarily have to buy in these expertise, depending on the case. So it's the increase in litigation. And secondly, in the period under review, I think we had two or three Dawn raids. This is where you kind of, it's a big operation, you go and raid offices, get their computers, analyze the information. That requires a lot of logistical support. You know, we've got to get the police escorting us to these offices, and we've got to get a lot of technical support around analyzing, particularly electronic information. So we seize computers, we've got to go through all of that and get and find things. So that's I think that accounts for higher fees with respect to consulting professional fees.
Just to add on two things. I had a slightly different understanding of what your question was on the 5%.
I think your understanding was correct.
Okay.
Because my understanding, the question was based on the 5% of cases that
we budget to lose,
you budget
or face
to
losing.
Yeah.
Yes.
According to what I got from your report,
yeah,
it's like it's a deliberate thing. I understand,
mm-hmm,
but I didn't understand the reasons behind that.
Yeah.
But this sort of gave me something, even though the question was not real. Because I thought you were deliberately, doing that in order to avoid certain cases. But it's fine.
Okay.
I think I'm covered.
All right.
Yeah.
The only other thing I was going to add is that sometimes there may be an area of the law which is not tested.
Okay.
But you need clarity. So you might take the case knowing that, look, this is not necessarily a good point, but wanting the precedent. And we often make that decision in the interest of future investigation. I don't know whether Mayor had a question on the difference between corruption and collusion. I don't think the commissioner touched on that. I mean, one of the big things is that for us, we don't have jurisdiction over corruption because it's a crime which would fall under the criminal justice section. And as a crime, what it involves is, the situation of there being someone who pays a person in public power in order to benefit from their decision. Whereas with collusion, we would be going against competitors for an agreement they've reached between themselves. So in the context of public procurement as an area, we as the Commission have been empowering public procurement officials to detect collusion, which is the agreement amongst competitors when they submit tenders. But there is also the aspect that there is potential for corruption, in the sense that there may be both an agreement amongst the competitors and a corrupt payment to a person within Treasury to ensure that a specified individual wins a tender. So as the Commission, we would be only looking at the collusion aspect, and the criminal investigation authorities would deal with the corruption side of things. So often it can be, both types of activities can be involved, but our jurisdiction would end at the collusion.
Collusion, corruption, to us it's the same. It's a corrupt practice. For you legal people, you can differentiate, but to us it's the same. It's tantamount to one thing, corrupt activity. May you wanted to follow up on something?
I was just wondering that this allows, why does it, why the government or whoever is in power treat it differently? Because it's somehow a crime, it's a wrong thing, someone is being, unfairly treated when we talk about our rights, that we all have rights to justice. So we see other people who cannot defend themselves being, the opportunity to exercise their rights and also benefit them from the prosecution as far as justice is concerned. So I'm back to Member Ntuli's question, if you allow that, what is it that you can do to make sure that you investigate in detail and root out whatever you see corruption, like Chai is saying. We use this word loosely, but you understand what I say.
What we're doing as an institution, we think is probably the right decision. Let's have clarity on the law that we have. If the Concord comes back with decisions that say the act is defective in some way, then we can come back to you and make suggestions for the act to be strengthened to enable us to achieve our mandate. But we think it would be premature now to circumvent the process on the law as it stands. And try to deal with these issues with an amendment. I mean, as we see with the current Amendment Act that's been passed into law, there can be problems even when you try to fix a statute. And I think the guidance from the Constitutional Court will enable us, if it's a problem with the statute itself, it will direct us in terms of what are the areas that need clarification, which ones can be crafted better, so that even we as an institution can be able to achieve our mandate.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we have really, I think it's because of time, but I think we've managed really to cover most of the issues. One, I think we will make sure that we follow up on the amendment bill issue through the Speaker's office. I guess we have to write a letter to that regard, because we did not process that. It was processed before the term of office. So the trade and industry then processed it. As a result, we did ask the department, but they promised to look into it. But I think we'll have to follow up through our own channels. On the space issue, yes, we raised it with the DG. He's given us a promise that there is progress and there are particular developments that would lead to the space issue being resolved. So we're hoping that you won't have that problem. The staff complement issue, I think this is related to your budget, the way I understand it. We'll have to raise it when we talk with the department further on there. In our next meeting, but we'll have to raise it also as part of our BRRR report. I think those are the issues that I felt we will deal with, we'll assist you with. But you haven't been providing us with your newsletter. Is there a reason why? No. We are one of your stakeholders, and you can't afford not to. And very important one for that matter. That was on the right enough. Okay. Would like to get a copy, if possible. If we need maybe to subscribe, maybe something that you can tell us so that we do something. Thank you very much. Otherwise, Mr. Ramburu and your team for the briefing and for the continuous good work that you're doing. In everything you do good, or when you're in motion, obviously there will be something that people talk about. And it means you are doing something. If you hear people not saying anything, it means you are stagnant, nothing is happening. So to us, it's a good thing if people begin to understand who you are and begin to challenge you and give you something, you know, extra to really deal with. To us, it's very important. And it also sensitizes us as a committee on various issues. Thank you very much for the clear explanations that you've given us. Thanks to the members, really. for your consistency and especially in attendance, and also for your contribution. We are now going to break for lunch, as also at the same time I am calling off the meeting. Not calling off, actually finishing. I'm adjourning the mission at the meeting. We have lunch. It is downstairs. As we go down, the old assembly restaurant is in there. You are invited. Yes, you are invited. Thank you. Yeah.